Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming today to the Agenda Festival. My name is Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie magazine. Ah, wonderful. Got some relations in the house. And you're all extremely young, but you are all perfect market for the Oldie, set up by the great Richard Ingrams over 30 years ago in 1992. A general interest, highly amusing magazine, and its two most amusing, most brilliant columnists are here today with me, Mary Kenny and Anne Wilson, two titans of the literary and journalistic world. Mary has been described as the grande dame of Irish journalism and has been a journalist for almost 60 years, is that right, Mary? She was very famous as the lead figure in the Irish women's liberation movement. She may not want to talk about it, but she was on the contraception train in 1971 and has written many books, but most recently, last year, The Way We Were, Catholic Ireland, since 1922. And before that, she wrote Something of Myself and Others, a memoir. Anne Wilson is one of our leading men of letters, a journalist and writer for, dare I say it, half a century, who has written biographies of everyone from Hitler to C.S. Lewis, from John Betjeman to Charles Dickens, and his most recent book, which came out last year, is Confessions, A Life of Failed Promises. I was going to begin by asking you, Andrew, with the sad news of the death of Martin Amis, age 73, at the weekend. Andrew, you're in that famous photo in 1983 of the most promising novelists under 40. You look about 12 in that picture. What do you think of Martin Amis as a man and as a writer?
Well, funnily enough, that photo was taken just along the river at Chelsea Harbour. A completely vanished world. Martin Amis, who traded on being a kind of cool dude and rather cynical and writing quite nastily about, particularly about women, was in person, like a lot of people who write nasty things, absolutely charming and very, very polite. I always value politeness very much in a person. And he was, on the whole, polite, though he lost his temper with me once. We were neighbours, funnily enough, in North London. Only he lived in something called Five Regents Park Road, and I lived in Five Regents Park Terrace, so we were always getting one of those posts, and he was sometimes quite annoyed. And I met his wife. They'd just had a baby, at least I thought they'd just had a baby. It was about 2 or 3 years before, in fact. And she was coming away from the toy shop in Parkway, with this tiny little bicycle. It was about that big, and it had stabilizers on the back wheel. But it was really only about that big. And she said, "I just bought this bike. What do you think about it?" And I said, "I expect we'll see Martin riding around Regent's Park in a minute," because he was absolutely minute. And it was the only time where I saw him completely lose his sense of humour. He didn't think it was funny at all. I think it's only when I become old, like some members of this audience, but by no means all, it's become clear to me how much the body that the Almighty put us into before we were born matters so much. Whether we're tall, whether we're short, whether we're black, whether we're white, the look of us is so self-defining. And the fact that he was tiny, I think, was really the defining thing about him. He was the sort of dwarf of the family, the titch, and must have been teased all the time about it. And then, of course, was literally having to live up to having a writer father. I'm very lucky. I had a wonderful father who wasn't a writer. And so I didn't have to worry about that. But Martin was always in competition with his father. And on the whole, great as some of his things were, I think he always failed that competition. I remember Kingsley saying to me once, "The trouble with Martin, he's a stylist, but he doesn't have anything to write about."
So we're going to talk today about the extraordinary people that Mary and Andrew have met, but we're also going to talk about writing and writing memoirs that both Mary and Andrew have done. And Mary, at the beginning of your extremely good memoir, you quote George Orwell, who says, "No autobiography is plausible unless it contains something disgraceful and shameful about the writer's story, a brilliant quote. In your terrific memoir, you talk about your late husband, the very distinguished foreign correspondent, Dick West, and the great difficulty of caring for him for, would it be almost a decade, in quite graphic detail. Did you worry about that, the effect on your family of revealing all these details?
Well, yes, that was in this book called Something of Myself, and I did have quite a long section about being a carer when Richard had a stroke and deteriorated little by little and so on, and how, you know, it was... The thing is, Harry, I wrote it at at exact point where I knew he wouldn't read it, you know, because he had become very fragile by 2013, and I knew that that book would never get into his hands. So therefore I was fairly confident that there wouldn't be anything absolutely hurtful to him, because he wouldn't see it, as it were. But I wanted to try and explore this. It's a very complicated role to play, and I'm not really, having been, you know, a very selfish person most of my life, and a very self-seeking and ambitious little minx, you know, I wasn't really cut out to be this altruistic sort of person, in a way. And I suppose also in terms of, you know, being involved in feminism and so on, where there were so many discussions about how women are expected to be kind of self-sacrificing, and feminism contained this great denunciation of the angel in the house, this wonderful, devoted sort of person who gives up her life, where feminism really was affirming women's own autonomy. Of course, as Andrew says about the body, old age soon teaches you that your autonomy is, you know, is quite limited, really. But anyway, so it was trying to explain and describe this situation where you want to care for somebody you love, and at the same time you will have a feelings of both guilt and resentment as well, mixing it all together, but wanting to do the best, but knowing also that your life is being, what remains of your life is being eaten up as well.
That's what's so good about it there, Mary, that your description of Dick. I knew Mary's husband, and it's just wonderful, actually, the way you are so honest about your feelings, and the feelings of resentment mingled with love. And also, of course, it is unfair when you're the one who's the healthy one. It's far worse to be the carer than to be the cared for in every possible way. And you just describe it very movingly and also wittily, as everything you've
done. Thank you. But I suppose as we all get older, I mean, it's a subject that concerns us all, that we all think about. Does, yes.
Andrew,
so much,
in your memoir, you're excoriating about yourself. In fact, the title is Confessions, A Life of Failed Promises.
Yes.
And you're very honest about your first wife, the distinguished Shakespeare scholar, Catherine Duncan Jones, who sadly suffered from Alzheimer's. You describe her walking down the street with a plastic bag with a couple of bottles of Pinot Grigio clinking away. How much did you feel you could reveal? Again, it's a very similar situation, but about your ex-wife.
Well, certainly we weren't together, but it was similar, because I used to see her most days, in fact, by then. And the thought, of course, which passed through Mary's head, at least the person I'm writing about will never read. There's something ruthless about our trade, though, Mary, isn't there? There really is.
Well, isn't it Graham Greene's, you know, thing about the slice of ice in the heart of the writer?
It's absolutely true. And whether you're writing novels or whether you're writing journalism, we would sell our own grandmothers. So it's almost the definition of it, certainly of a journalist. And,
well, Mary, you quote the late Nick Tomlin, who refers to having rat-like cunning, and you had a wonderful scoop as a young journalist. You were travelling on the Queen Mary with the former Foreign Secretary, George Brown, who, as you said in that nice Irish term, was fond of drink.
Poor George Brown, I completely ruined his career. I was a dreadful little vixen, because I was sent by the Evening Standard to travel across the Atlantic on the last trip of the Queen Mary. And the night before, so in New York, and the night before the Queen Mary was sort of to depart, there was a big party sort of down by the dock side. It was terribly glamorous and everything like that. And George Brown was there. And I went over to him and I said, "Oh, Mr. Brown, will you dance with me?" Because I did discover when I was about 19 or 20 that if you ask any middle-aged older man and you're a young woman in a miniskirt, they will usually dance with you.
Strange, isn't it?
It's called the natural law, you know. And I suppose some of us now are sort of horrified that anybody who puts their hand on your knee is now called a sexual harassment, because certainly we boldly went forward to engage ourselves with these old chaps. And of course he did. He did, and he came forward, but he did have a few taken. So anyway, there we were dancing, and the dance was called the Frog at the time, which is one of these indefinable sort of dances. You just move around and so on. And there was a photographer there, and he took a picture of George on the dance floor with my where I had lured him. And I don't know if you remember, there was inevitably some crisis at 10 Downing Street. At the time, and Harold Wilson was struggling with it, and George Brown said to me something, because he didn't know I was a reporter at all. He said, "I'm not going to be brought down by these buggers," you know. He said something a little bit indiscreet like that, which, of course, I wrote down my own got on the transatlantic phone, and it was the splash headline of the first edition of the Evening Standard the next day: "George frogs the night away." I suppose, you know, when I look at poor, I would say Suella Braverman and Rishi Sunak now, you know, it's that sort of thing where the Prime Minister has to come back to deal with something that seems rather trivial. But anyway, and poor George Brown had to resign after that, and his career never recovered. And of course, I didn't think anything of it, because I think when you're young, you can be quite hard-hearted, you know.
Yes, and you have to be with public figures. They have literally asked for it.
In any case, just as a code, Andrew, I did find out later two things about George Brown. First of all, he had a reputation for getting very drunk, but actually he had a very, very low threshold, apparently, and he could be, you know, quite intoxicated on two glasses of wine. The second thing was, you know, he sort of retired into private life, married, I think, a second time, and became a Roman Catholic.
He did.
So that was
as a result of that famous encounter at the Peruvian embassy.
Which you will have to recount, Andrew, of the great stories.
He was at the Peruvian embassy when he was still foreign secretary. And rather as the occasion when he met Mary, he advanced towards this beautiful creature in a lovely purple frock. And he went up, and as the music began, he said, "This music is for us. We're going to dance to it, because you're the most beautiful woman in the room." And the person replied, "That's not the case, for three reasons. One is, this isn't dance music, it's the Peruvian national anthem." Secondly, it's very flattering of you, but I'm not a beautiful woman, I'm actually a man. And thirdly, I am the Cardinal Archbishop of Lima. So maybe that's what led him to the faith, who knows?
But Andrew, Mary's spoken very honestly about a ruthless stitching up for George Brown, but actually, wouldn't you agree that journalists are in fact, I would say this as one, but they're actually much nicer and better company than full-time writers? You're both, but I count you as an honorary journalist from the point of view of this discussion.
Well, I mean, the trouble with most poets and novelists is that they're tremendously self-important. I don't know why. We were talking a little bit about this earlier, and we wonder whether it's because they're always on their own, rather like dons who spend most of their time on their own, university teachers. They develop pomposity and self-importance, whereas journalists, on the whole, in my experience, aren't self-important. There are a few of us who are a bit self-important, but on the whole, we meet in bars, we swap a lot of gossip, And I've always found journalists the best company in the world. In fact, I'm rather like Lord Beaverbrook, who used to say he pitied anyone who wasn't a journalist.
And Mary, you in your memoir, you do say what fun it is to be a journalist, isn't it?
Well, in Fleet Street it was great fun, I must say. And there was this sense which young journalists actually don't really have anymore, because it's become much more fragmented and people are working much more on their own on their laptops and so on. But there was a real sort of camaraderie, you know, about journalism, where we used to meet in Elvino and under the picture of La Veuve Clicquot. And, there was a wonderful... we all have our mentors and the people who influence us and so on. And there was a wonderful opera critic called Philip Pope Wallace, who was a great legend in his time, and he used to sit under this picture and call, "Another bottle of the widow, please." You know, this was when calling for another bottle of Veuve Clicquot. And he would tell all these marvellous stories, and older journalists would come in and tell these legendary stories of, you know, how they'd... James Cameron's famous story that he was sent off to the Middle East, you know, and he came back and he filled in his expenses and he said, "Taxi to Victoria Station, 5 shillings, to hire a camel, 2,000 That's it was a sort of esprit de corps, which really was. At the same time, there's a side of journalism which is a very sort of scallywag side, and it was, I mean, you mentioned Nick Tomlin there, and he did say that what somebody wanted, the requirements for journalism were a plausible manner, some literary ability, and rat-like cunning. You know, and Nick Tomlin was a very fine journalist, actually killed in the Yom Kippur War in 73. But so it was a very gregarious time, and we all drank like fishes. It was disgraceful, actually, how much we drank. And I mean, there was a very famous occasion when I won't particularly name him because it wouldn't be fair, he's long dead, but a very famous columnist had finished for the day and went off to one of the taverns in Fleet Street, you know, to imbibe as they did, you know, and then came over the wires this terrible story: the President of the United States had been assassinated, JFK's. And of course, the story came through at about 6 o'clock our time. So some young journalist was sent to crawl through the various taverns and pubs of Fleet Street to find this famous commentator, because he had known JFK and had interviewed him, and he was brought back to the office. And he was so intoxicated that his fingers went between the interstices of the typewriter. But in some way, the young amanuensis was able to deduct from what he was saying, and this was in the Daily Express, which of course was at the time the ace reporter's newspaper, and they managed to get something together. But I think he did give up the drink after that.
But it was a reflection of the gregariousness of Fleet Street. The late Alan Watkins, who you both knew, a distinguished political journalist, who towards the end of his life would file his copy from home, and for the first time in many years he went into the Independent on Sunday office, and was in Canary Wharf, and was amazed to find complete silence with everyone tapping away at their screen, as opposed to the incredible chatting in Fleet Street. And so that was where stories came from, wasn't it, Andrew?
Yes, it was from chat. It definitely was from chat. I mean, what's extraordinary about most of the Fleet Street papers is that, although Mary's politely said that they wrote their articles and then went to imbibe, in fact, because of the timetable, most of them imbibed, and then it's about 4:30 or 5, whenever you finish lunch, if you're a journalist, they went back to the office, and that was when they wrote things like the leaders of the Daily Telegraph. I mean, there was a divide, because the Telegraph were in the quays, weren't they, the pubs, and some of the lesser mortals were in other pubs, Cheshire Cheese or something, and then the real creme de la creme, like Mary and Philip Hope Wallace, were in Elvino. Obitite, anyway, of course, Elvino's.
of course, the Kings and Keys, which was... It was composed, the clientele were half high Tory telegraph writers and half Irish Trotskyists.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the conversation was very stimulating.
Mary, you refer in your lovely book to talking to former editor of the Daily Mail on the question of graduates versus non-graduates in journalism, and I think he said graduates might be better educated, but non-graduates were hungrier. Well, you also admit that you're very chippy about not going to university.
Oh, yes.
But do you think it makes any difference at all? You're an absolutely brilliant journalist and writer. It hasn't held you back in the slightest, has it?
No, I'm still incredibly chippy, Harry. I mean, I'm 79 years of age and I still want to go to Trinity College Dublin. Which was, of course, even more piquant because it was banned for Catholics at the time. You know, the Archbishop of Dublin thought it was an occasion of sin, which made it all the more attractive, of course. And no, I left school at 16 and so... I've sort of had to make my way in the world, and I do really, really envy people who've had a good... I mean, Andrew writes in his marvellous memoir about his academic life, and I think it's a wonderful thing, and I think it does train the mind. But that conversation with Paul Dacre was interesting. I did ask him, you know, whether he preferred, as journalists who were, and this was the turn of the century, about 2000, whether they were graduates or whether they had come straight from school. And he said, just as you said, that the graduates had a much better discipline, if you like, but that people who came straight from school were hungrier or more ambitious. And I remember when I first came to Fleet Street, I actually worked for a time as a secretary on The Guardian, and I remember an older night editor who was from the North of England, from the old Manchester Guardian. He was actually prejudiced against graduates. He said, "We don't want varsity, smart aleck varsity men here. We want good working class lads and lasses, you know, coming in who are ready." And I suppose that is the downside, that the overwhelming all journalists now are graduates. And it has, if you like, put off working class kids from...
I totally agree. And also I think, although it's true to say universities train your mind, that's what I've got against them, actually. because I think it often makes those minds that have been trained very, very boring. And I think the better writers, journalists or poets or whoever they may be, Ted Hughes used to say this, have to unlearn everything they learn at university, really, in order to be writers. And I think of some of the best journalists I've known have certainly, thinking of your definition of a good journalist with the cunning and so forth, another Express journalist of long ago told me that he'd been asked to get into the King Edward VII Hospital to get an interview with Harry Macmillan, because there was a rumour that the Prime Minister wasn't very well, and that's why he'd gone into the Edward VII Hospital. And he said, "I can't get into that hospital. It's, you know, it's a very grand hospital. It's where the Queen goes and everything else. I mean, how do you get into a hospital?" And his employer on William Hickey, who I think was Sir John Junior at the time, or the future Sir John Junior, produced a stethoscope out of his He went and sounded Harold Macmillan's chest, and he came out, of course, with the scoop of the century, which was that he was just about to go downstairs and tender his resignation to the Queen. But he was posing as the young, gallant young houseman.
On that front, Andrew, one of your famous scoops was about the Queen Mother, where some people wrongly attacked you for writing down her table talk. What's the real story there?
Well, that's such a boring story.
No, you must tell it, though.
Well, I was asked to meet the Queen Mother, and we had dinner with another old rogue called Woodrow Wyatt, who had a column called The Voice of Common Sense, rather inapt. It was in the News of the World. Anyway, so there were a lot of journalists around the table. It was me, Peregrine Worthorn, Woodrow Wyatt, and the Queen Mother. And she told a perfectly harmless anecdote, which I've heard since lots of members of the royal family have told. There was an evening in the war to raise money for some worthy cause. I've forgotten now what it was, but it might have been for the Free French. I think it was for the Free French in London. And English poets were asked to a London theatre to read to a... It was a charity event. And the King and Queen and the little princesses were in the front row. And they had all their friends, like Osbert Sitwell and so forth, whom they loved. And then this lugubrious man came onto the stage and started reading. And the Queen Mother said, "I couldn't remember what it was called. It might have been called The Desert, this poem he'd written." And he looked just like a bank manager. And first the king had the jewels, and then the little princesses had the jewels, and then I had the jewels. And I think it was called the desert, but I can't remember. And I said it wasn't by any chance called the wasteland. She said it was. And I said, as a matter of fact, he did work in a bank while he was writing. Anyway, I thought it was an absolutely harmless story, but Woodrow, of all people, who had wrote down everything she said, including very right-wing things, he accused me of having been terribly indiscreet. So that was that one. If I ever did have an obituary, which I probably wouldn't, it'll just be blabbermouth dies.
One of the other great joys of journalism is meeting people from different generations, like you meeting the Queen Mother. I had the good fortune to work with a great Bill Deeds at the Telegraph for many years, had been a war hero and a cabinet minister, and was a walking encyclopedia in 2001. It was the 50th anniversary of the Festival of Britain, and Charles Moore, the editor of the Telegraph, said to Bill, do you remember it? Was it any good? He said, oh, absolutely marvellous. Not a patch on the Empire exhibition in 1924 at Wembley. And it was wonderful to have that range. And you talk again, Mary, you have these extraordinary people you've met. You met Marlon Brando, Marlene Dietrich. They're not actually necessarily always that interesting in the flesh, is that right, these greats?
Well, it's just, I think, people who have been interviewed a lot of time haven't got new things to say, really. Whereas somebody who's never been interviewed is absolutely fresh and has... And I do remember with the Dietrich, I mean, you know, I thought Dietrich was absolutely the most amazing star. I thought she was absolutely terrific. And then I was sent to interview, and she was performing at the Café Royal, and she did look... I mean, she was quite tired-looking, but very well put together, obviously, still. I think this would have been late 1960s. But she was very gloomy that evening, you know, and she didn't really say very much. All she said was, all my friends are dead. Hemingway is dead. Cocteau is dead. They are all dead. I think John Wayne was actually still alive, but I'm not sure. But she was very friendly with him too. So in fact, the conversation wasn't really very sparkling, but it was something. But now I sometimes, you know, as I go to more and more funerals, I now identify with that when I think, you know, so many of my dear friends are dead, you know. And I do understand that reflex now, yeah, much more, that, you know, you're losing the whole generation that you knew and so on, which is,
absolutely,
you know.
The other thing about it's an interesting point about interviews of famous people. Anthony Pohl, the great novelist, who I think was your cousin, wasn't he, Harry?
Great uncle, yeah.
Great uncle.
Yeah.
He used to say that when people come and interview you, it always reminded him of being in the army. You have your kit inspected every so often, either by a sergeant major or by one of the officers. And this wasn't a very nice experience. You kept some kit which you never actually used. You kept your beautifully blanketed spats. That wasn't the stuff you actually used or wore. And you spread it all out on your bed when you knew there was going to be an inspection. But it wasn't the real kit. And he said that's what it's like when you're interviewed by a journalist. You just present them with this stuff, which is just routine. And I notice it over and over again in papers. With the more famous the person is, the more, when you see they're being interviewed, that they say the same old things that they said in the last interview and the one before. Whereas the rising star, or the person that isn't normally interviewed, you might get something out of. Unless, of course, you're one of these really brilliant interviewers, like Lynn Barber, whose birthday I see it is today in the paper, who does persuade. I mean, she was the one who persuaded Jimmy Savile. It was astonishing, having printed that in the Sunday paper, that the police didn't come around the next morning, but anyway, to more or less admit the kind of life he had.
And is it different, Andrew, when you were writing your terrific memoir, if you're writing about your father? You write very movingly and honestly about your father, who was the head of the Wedgwood factory in Stoke-on-Trent, and then you're quite brutal about him at times, but did writing about him change your feelings about him?
Very much so, because writing about him, I did think sometimes I was being unkind, because he did turn into the most fantastic bore, and couldn't stop telling anecdotes. I know exactly the feeling, as you've already seen it. But I did come to revere him, because he'd done so many good things with his life, including making and designing beautiful objects, and building a factory. His sole motivation in building that factory with the ever-lamented Josiah V Wedgwood was to have a factory which didn't kill people who worked in this. I mean, most of the people who worked in Stoke-on-Trent until they built that factory died aged 35 of silicosis. And they built this electric factory, which, of course, then you had a normal lifespan. So things like that. He was so practical, he was so clever, and he was a sweet and gentle and lovely man. And I fell in love with him again, writing about him. Even though, as I say, he turned, as we probably all do, into a most prattling bore.
Mary, your terrific memoir, as well as talking about your life, actually is an extremely good book about journalism. I'd recommend anyone in the audience who either wants to become a journalist or do journalism, or their children and grandchildren are interested in it. It's extremely good. The number one thing, which I feel very strongly as an editor, is reliability. However drunk you are, however hungover, always file on time. And you had a very reliable, was she an assistant, who had the name of Delia Smith. Whatever happened to her?
No, I hired Delia Smith when I was briefly features editor of the Evening Standard in 1972, wasn't it? And she was just a terrific interviewee. She absolutely, you could just tell she was completely reliable. You could believe anything she said. Anything she said she would do, she'd do. She also left school, I think, quite young and started in the kitchens and so on at age 16. Now, I was very briefly as features editor of the Evening Standard, and I was really appointed to this because the editor felt it was time to have a woman in that position. There were no women executives whatsoever in most of Fleet Street at that time, and so I was appointed. But I was completely underqualified for the job. I was completely at sea. I was useless at reading spreadsheets and all these things, you know. And that experience has made me very much against token appointments, hiring somebody because they tick some certain box, one whether of what sex or gender or ethnicity or so on, and it absolutely convinced me that you should always hire the person who's best for the job, really, you know.
You obviously did hire the best person for the job.
I was terrible. I was really, it was humiliating. But on the other hand, you know, you do learn a lot from failure. You learn a huge amount from failure, much more than you do from success, which I think is an old Jesuit idea. But when we were talking about interviews, of course, Lynn Barber is probably the best, one of the best of the business, but she's so good that people are afraid to be interviewed by her. You know, so that's that has actually been one of the problems that's developed. And I think the interview format has very much changed because there are far more consultants, public relations people, and so on around the star now, that it's really hard to get to sort of get. The last kind of celebrity interview I did for the Daily Express was with Pierce Brosnan, and you know, it was there were sort of 6 or 8 or 10 journalists all lined up outside in a room in the Shelburne Hotel in Dublin, each having half an hour with the star.
Yeah, and they imitate the Americans, don't they? Which is they insist everything's recorded and
absolutely.
When you and I have been sent over to America, I remember when I interviewed Dr. Billy Graham.
Yeah.
But it was all recorded and wouldn't let you out of the hotel. It was done in a Marriott hotel.
Sort of security.
Until they played it all back, and then they would come rushing out and say, you can use that bit, you can use that bit, but you mustn't use that bit.
So you're being
even
controlled.
Though it was on the record. And funnily enough, I noticed when I began to work at the Telegraph that some of the personalities or famous people in England had adopted that. Indeed, it happened to me when I was sent to interview an Archbishop of Canterbury. Someone came running after me out of Lambeth Palace and said, we've just played back the tape. I didn't know there had been a tape, and you mustn't use that bit.
Paul McCartney, well, I interviewed him once, he records you, or his men do, and he films you to make sure that if you were to say something rude about his then-dyed hair, he could say it wasn't as bad as it was.
Can I just interject with, you know, how it could have been in the olden days when Barry Norman went to interview Richard Burton back in the late 60s, they went on a three-day bender together. And so that was the interview, and there were no PRs, and there was nobody controlling it. And obviously it was absolutely epic, you noticed.
Yes, of course.
Andrew, you've been poacher and gamekeeper, because as well as being a distinguished writer and journalist, you're also literary editor of The Standard. And I think you said that to begin with, you thought you were going to get the world's greatest writers writing about the world's greatest writers, Proust reviewing Shakespeare, as it were. By the end, you just wanted them to file on time and be able to spell the word cat correctly.
That is the only thing you want. It's just, I remember there was a young man, I don't know if it, I think it was you actually, but he was never named to me. Yeah. Who rather innocently asked Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail, why are we paying that A.N. Wilson to write all this rubbish which he can dash off in half an hour? And Dacre replied, it's because he can dash it off in half an hour, whereas ask someone else, they'll say they'll do it today and you won't get it till the end of the week.
It wasn't me, but anyway, his answer is correct.
Reliability.
Yes,
in journalism, as in all other aspects of life, is so important. You mentioned Delia Smith being reliable. I once did a little bit of telly work, and the cameraman said, we loved working with Delia Smith, but the directors hated her. And I said, oh, why is that? Both, why did you love her, and why did the directors hate her? She refuses to do more than one take. So if she's doing a program about how to boil an egg, which she's very clever at doing, she looks straight at the camera. She never says she never says ah, she never repeats herself. She tells you brilliantly how to do it, and that's that. And then the director says, darling, I think it would look better if you did it with the sunlight coming in this room. She does, I mean, she's far too polite to say off, as Paul Dacre would, but she simply refuses, because she's a pro. She does a one-take show.
We've got 5 minutes left, so anybody who'd like to ask Mary or Andrew a question, please do put up your hand. And we haven't got mics, but if you shout, we'll hear you.
Did you either of you do shorthand?
Did either of you do shorthand, Mary?
Yes, but I could never read back my own.
Andrew?
I do my own version of shorthand, but that's very funny.
Any other questions?
Mary, which is your most favourite interview of all time?
The question was, what was Mary's most favourite interview of all time?
Oh, gosh. I don't really know, actually. Well, I was very impressed by a wonderful Russian poet called Irina Ratishinskaya. And I didn't include... I sort of forgot about her. She was a dissident poet and deep Christian, and she suffered so much in the Soviet Union, but she kept writing, and she was so inspiring and sincere and really wonderful. And I also interviewed a wonderful French Dr. Jérôme Lejeune, who actually discovered the chromosome which causes Down syndrome. But he had such a tender attitude to the disabled children that he identified. It was really, really moving. You know, it was quite a short interview, but I've never forgotten him, really. I thought he was marvellous.
And time for one more question. A lady towards the back. Yes, you... Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was curious. What's the worst thing you've ever been called in print?
Great question. What's the worst thing you've both been called in print, Andrew?
I was once called... a piece of sick on the pavement. The person who wrote it was my girlfriend at the time. That was the end of the relationship.
Dare we ask who she was?
Well, she's rights for the oldie, I'll put
right.
it that way.
Mary.
Golly. Perhaps I've put it out of my mind. I can't remember, but I do go on Twitter sometimes, which perhaps is sometimes mistaken. One does get called dreadful things on Twitter constantly, but it's a very interesting source of information, nevertheless, and it's sometimes a source of wit. And anyway, you're constantly called a disgusting human being and so on for the most, what seems to be the most innocuous reasons. But I return to my convent education and think this is a good time to practice humility.
Well, that's a very good place to stop. I must say, we haven't touched, I'm afraid, on your book on Ireland, Mary, but you must be the only person who's been both complimented by the Queen on your book and kissed by Gerry Adams. But I'd like to thank two great titans of writing, Mary Kenny and Anne Wilson, and all of you for coming.